Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's 8:16 p.m. Time to talk theater, time to get theatrical with my very special guest, Jonathan Kalb. He is chairman of the theater department at CUNY's Hunter College. He was also a critic for The Village Voice and The New York Press, has written for The New York Times and American Theater Magazine. He is the author of Beckett in Performance and The Theater of Heiner Müller, and he has a brand new book, Play by Play, Theater Essays and Reviews, 1993 to 2002, published by Limelight Editions. Jonathan Kalb, I want to welcome you to Dave's Gone By.
Thank you.
Hi, Jonathan. How you doing?
I'm
How
fine.
Was your good weekend?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. Now, I should explain that my first acquaintance with Jonathan was when I was writing for a theater website. I was doing news stories about the theater, and it was at the time when you had stopped writing for the New York Press because they had said that they didn't want theater in the paper anymore. They found it boring. It was just not to their taste because I guess it was kind of a right-wing publication. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that whole story and how you came out of that experience, which was a bit shocking for you at the time.
Well, I tell the story of New York Press in my book, so people who are really curious about it can read the whole dirty story if they like. I don't have rancor in my heart about being fired from a place that never had a lot of comfort about me being there in the first place. You know, I lasted 4 years at New York Press as a weekly columnist, and that was much more than twice as long as any of their other theater writers. The people who ran New York Press were not friendly to my kind of thinking, my kind of writing, and my kind of criticism, and I think that they were just curious in 1997, when I was first hired there, about how their readership, or what they perceived as their readership, would react to serious criticism. And at that time they had a really serious film critic too, Godfrey Cheshire, who was also fired around the time I was. The paper was expanding, and they would have hired a good dance critic, a good television critic, if they could have found one. But when economic times got harder and the paper started shrinking, you know, the people who ran the paper got together and they all asked each other, "Do you go to the theater? Do you ever go to the theater?" And none of them ever went to the theater. And they used that as a guide to what was interesting to their readership, and they said, "Well, let's just get rid of the theater column."
And what was weirdly ironic was that a few weeks later, they popped up with another theater column that lasted just a few weeks. And do you remember who that was written by?
Well, Mimi Kramer.
No, she's writing now. I mean, this is later they got Mimi Kramer.
Yeah.
But in between, they actually had Klaus von Bülow, of all people, writing theater reviews from England, which I found rather astonishing. I don't know if you recall that.
No, I don't read New York Press regularly. I didn't before I wrote for them,
but Mimi Kramer did come in after that, and she's been there on and off, I think, for a little while now.
Yeah, well, you know, Mimi's a perfectly respectable critic. She's also a friend of the former owner, and she wanted that job the whole time. And you know, that's one way to look at it. she just wanted the job. But they don't carry that much theater criticism. People who look at the paper more regularly have told me. I think that they were true to their word. That they just don't.
Theater's
very important.
Yeah.
You know?
No, she's not in there every week. But what is kind of interesting is that before the New York Press, you were at the Village Voice.
Yeah.
Which since it is a left wing publication devoted very seriously to off and off Broadway, or at least when it had more money or room, it certainly was. And yet, even there, you did find it a little difficult to make your voice heard.
Well, you know, I have to be fair to the people at New York Press. I was never censored there. I wrote a lot of things that were very contrary to what they believed about the world, and I was never told not to write. Furthermore, I was given as much space as I wanted at New York Press. My column was 1,200 to 1,600 words, and it could run longer if I wanted. And at the Village Voice, when I first started there in 1987, what was called a full review was 700 to 800 words. By the time I stopped writing at the Voice in 97, a full review, what was called a full review, was 500 words. Mm-hmm. And they were writing these things called cameos, asking us to do cameo reviews called, which were 100 to 150 words. And, you know, there's a politics to that, too. It's the politics of abbreviation and brevity. It's the politics of bite size, everything, ad speak, and so on and so forth.
And who is deciding which shows get 100 and which shows get the 500 words and which shows get the Michael Feingold treatment.
Right, but my point is that, you know, whatever you want to say about conservatism, there are different types of conservatism, and one type of conservatism wants people who know what they're talking about to have space to say what they think. That's the good side of the right-wing attitude. As long as it lasted, I think it was a fine place to write in New York Press. I had only myself to blame, never the paper, if I didn't say anything perfectly or if I didn't come out quite the way I wanted.
Yeah,
I mean, never say that about The Voice.
Yeah. Well, I will say for the New York Press that although sometimes I find their film critics unintelligible, they're real critics. I mean, still now, they may not have Cheshire, but they have Armand White and I forget the other fellow's name. And they are given the room to expand rather seriously about film.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to ask you now about the book Play by Play, which opens with a lecture that you gave at Barnard College at NYU about the state of theater criticism today. And of course, not surprisingly, it's a mostly negative essay. If you could just get into that, why it's in such dire straits?
Well, I think we live in a time when almost everything that presents itself as criticism is not real criticism. It's some sort of opinion mongering. It's crypto advertising masquerading as objective commentary. You know, just about everything that appears in print is designed to confuse the public about the difference between objective commentary and public relations. And it becomes harder and harder in our time to find a niche, a place for a real critical voice. Criticism requires an independent forum. And what we have more and more are print forums and media outlets that are controlled by the very companies that make the products, the entertainment products. And there was a time in the 1960s, 1950s, when there were a lot of independent magazines and newspapers, and this didn't matter because there were a lot of there were a lot of people familiar with essay-like criticism about the various arts, and the various arts were seen as something you needed to know about if you were going to have aspirations to middle-class culture and so on and so forth. And all of that has changed now. You'll never find what you found in 1965, which is a Hollywood producer wanting to know what an intellectual critic really thought about a movie. They couldn't care less today because they can control the voices people read and people hear. We live in the era of what film people call the blurb whore, people who are paid to say flattering things. There's very, very few independent places to write, and so criticism itself gets squeezed out. I speak in the book about some what I think are quintessential episodes in the last couple of years, and one of them was Giuliani and the Sensation exhibit at Brooklyn Museum.
Right.
Because Giuliani wanted to close that museum down, not just the show, he wanted to close the museum down, deprive it of funding and so on, because he was offended by a exhibit that happened in the museum.
Was that the Madonna covered in doo-doo, or am I...
Right, there was elephant dung on Madonna. Actually, what I thought was an extremely reverential Madonna, frankly. He never saw the show.
Right.
And yet, I think, even though he never closed the show down and the museum down, that he won the fight. And the reason he won the fight is because he got everybody from the left, from the middle, from the right, to agree with his premise, which is that everyone's opinion of artworks, complex artworks, should be respected as long as he claims to be offended, no matter how ignorant that person is. That's the anti-critical ethos right there. It's that everyone's a critic. Hey, isn't everyone a critic? You know? And right there you have a little capsule of the attitude of our time, which is that people who are informed, people who know a little bit more, are seen as people to marginalize, people not to take seriously.
What comedian Bill Maher calls people who are out of the mainstream in his new show. He's saying that to be out of the mainstream should be a good thing, but it has become some kind of taint for people these days.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask a bit further about your kind of theater that we like, because we're talking a lot about your writing and where that can be and what the society is allowing writers to do. But if you read the book, then you'll see that the first section is devoted basically to Samuel Beckett, then there's some Mueller stuff, and then towards the very, very end is you squeeze like some Broadway shows that you saw. And is that sort of a conscious decision of the way that was laid out?
Well, I think that the way that it's laid out is that the longer essays are toward the front because I think that they're more substantial pieces. And the last third of the book are reviews, you know, weekly columns from New York Press. And I didn't mean to say that any of the work in the latter part of the book was less important than the work in the early part of the book, but I...
the work that you are reviewing, not your own writing necessarily, but I sort of get the feeling that you do hold to a higher level, off and off Broadway and avant-garde and European kinds of styles of theater than commercial Broadway.
Well, I think anybody who knows anything about the theater understands that it's been over a generation since Broadway was taken seriously as the source of important new theater art. Broadway is the commercial theater. It's Broadway represents what can exist in the theater under thoroughly commercial circumstances, and many, many people are interested in that, just as many, many people are interested in the pulp from broadcast TV, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There will always be, you know, a commercial theater. There will always be a popular theater that pays for itself exclusively through its vulgar advertising and its tits and ass and so on and so forth. And there's nothing wrong with that. It should exist. It does exist. But let's not confuse that with people who have aspirations to bring the theater to as an art to something new, to contribute something original to it. It's not that nothing good ever happens on Broadway. It does, and I write about a few things. It's that is very, very rarely the place to look for important new theater art.
I do want to move into that a little bit, but because I'm wondering if you might consider yourself someone who's more an advocate of director's theater than perhaps playwright's theater.
Well, you know, if I have any reputation at all, among people who read serious criticism, it's as someone who's been very, very hard on directors. All the reviewers of my previous collection, Free Admissions, said that I was very hard on directors. So even though I do like some, very, very aggressively interpretive directors, there's fewer of those kind of directors that I really admire than there are the other type.
Name a couple, real quick.
Well, there's a Belgian who's been directing a lot at New York Theater Workshop, Ivo van Hove, and I think he's really smart and really interesting, and I think he never got a fair shake from the American critics who were just...
They saw a streetcar in a bathtub, and
right.
That was what they saw.
Right, and he did more Stately Mansions.
Well, that was weird. I saw that one. That was weird.
Yeah. I think he's very, very intelligent, and that those plays in particular were ripe for, they're being exploded. They're American classics. They were ripe for being exploded by somebody who saw them from a totally different point of view. And I think people have a right to try things, even if they fall on their face. You know, I always thought Samuel Beckett, whom I revere, was wrong for trying to stop people from trying new things with his texts.
Can I ask really quick, and as the last question, as usual, I left like 15 minutes for this interview, and I should have left a half hour, but because it's just flown by. But why Beckett? Why is Beckett so important to you?
Oh, my goodness, where to start?
Beckett, in a minute or less.
Beckett is the indispensable playwright of this era. He straddles the modern and the postmodern. He straddles the print culture and media culture. People don't know that Beckett wrote plays for television and radio and a film. He's the playwright who has left us with the most severe challenges to what we assume to be important in theater art, and has made us think again about presence, live presence, in a time when we are thinking almost exclusively about virtuality and virtual presence. It's the indispensable oof in the modern canon.
Well, Thank you, Jonathan Kalb, for your virtual and live presence on Dave's Gone By. I want to remind people about your book, Play-by-Play Theater Essays and Reviews, available from Limelight Editions, which you can buy online from www.limelighteditions.com. Jonathan, I'm going to say goodbye to you, and I'm going to tell people how they can even win a copy of this book. So thanks for calling in.
Okay, thank you, Dave.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.